You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith reporting on the quiet panic about the coming storms, El Niño, what it is and what it isn't. Then stay tuned for positive steps from the Leaf Ninjas. Maybe you heard that a system called El Niño could further destabilize the weather and ring up another record hot year globally. The last big El Niño was in 1998, one of the hottest years on Earth, and a time of storms and firestorms in many parts of the world. The next may arrive soon. Scientists have been working furiously to find out how this weather system works. They also want to predict when an El Niño is coming. In the heart of that hunt is Dr. Shane McGregor. He's a research fellow at Australia's Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Dr. McGregor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the new science, let's cover a bit of the basics. What is El Niño?
So I think to understand El Niño, you need to first understand kind of the background conditions of the Pacific Ocean. So basically, the winds in the Pacific Ocean blow from east to west. Okay, and this causes a whole bunch of warm water to pile up in the western equatorial Pacific, and it makes the eastern equatorial Pacific quite cold. Now, during an El Niño event, that warm water that was normally piled up in the west sloshes back across the Pacific to the east and makes the whole equatorial Pacific east and west very warm.
Right, but then that becomes a complex system that appears to affect the rest of the world. So why should we care about what happens there in the Pacific? And why are governments and scientists racing to understand El Niño?
To answer the first part first, why do we care? The main thing is, so atmospheric convection, or like large-scale rainfall, occurs over the warm water. So when the warm water is piled up in the west, you have a whole bunch of kind of rainfall occurring in the western equatorial Pacific. During El Niño, when you move that warm water east, this rainfall kind of moves to the east as well. And in terms of the tropical Pacific, this rainfall is very important because it basically acts to fuel the atmospheric circulation cells. So basically, we're moving where we're putting this fuel into the atmosphere, which then in turn changes the atmospheric weather patterns around the globe.
And are there major and minor El Niño events?
Well, there's obviously like a whole spectrum of events, you know, so you can slosh just a little bit of the warm water from the west to the east, and you can slosh kind of all of it over. So there are definitely different magnitudes of events. And the interesting thing is there's kind of a distinction between the small ones and the big ones, and it's basically during a small one, you move the rainfall, the equatorial rainfall, from the west to about the central Pacific, and it's not warm enough to actually shift it the whole way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific. Whereas during the big El Niño events, the rainfall systems move from New Guinea and can extend the whole way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific, so almost the South American coast.
Okay. Now, for me, an important point is that since the last big El Niño in 1998, we've spent 16 years pouring even greater record amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and at least half of that, we're told, is absorbed by the oceans. Can these added gases and heat add up to an even bigger El Niño event than we've had in the past?
So it's really hard to kind of specify one particular event as being due to global warming, you know. So El Niño events are a regularly occurring natural phenomenon that have been occurring for hundreds, even thousands of years, according to paleo records. So it's really hard to just say one individual event is going to be enhanced or dampened due to global warming. So, yeah, I can't really answer that question specifically saying, yes, this one's going to be super big because it's El Niño. But there has been some research saying that the chances of getting big El Niño events is going to increase as we move to a warmer climate.
Well, for the science, I'd like to begin by asking about a recent paper that you co-authored, and the title is Late 20th Century Emergence of the El Niño Propagation Asymmetry and Future Projections. Shane McGregor, what did your team of authors hope to do with that paper?
Okay, what we hope to do during El Niño events, and the way they have been observed in the past, most of the sea surface temperature changes start out in the eastern equatorial Pacific and then they move to the central equatorial Pacific. Whereas the really big El Niño events of 1982-83 and 97-98 started in the central to western equatorial Pacific and moved eastward towards the west coast of South America. We set out to explain kind of why that happened, why those two events were so drastically different to the other ones in terms of their propagation characteristics. And then we kind of looked into what would happen to these kind of events in the future in regards to how ENSO is simulated in the climate models used in the current generation of IPCC models.
So in a language that someone without scientific training could understand, what are some of your conclusions?
The conclusions were that basically the events get so big, the current anomalies on the equatorial Pacific, like the surface winds, generally go from the east towards the west. For La Nina events and small El Nino events, the current anomalies still go that way. But for a big El Nino event, the changes in the currents are so strong that actually reverse these mean currents on the equator. And it's that fact that causes these events to propagate from west to east instead of from east to west.
So it's really a change in the current in the ocean is what you're saying?
Yeah, basically.
Well, now let's say I'm a government leader or an advisor. Does this new research help me prepare, or can we even prepare for such a big change in the global weather system?
That's a difficult question to answer. So in terms of just in forecasting El Nino events in general, one of the good things about them is, so basically the events are kind of starting to get initiated in the Northern Hemisphere summer is when the events will be initiated. They peak in the Northern Hemisphere winter, so around Christmas time they'll reach their peak magnitude. And then they kind of decay in the following spring. So once an event has started, you have a good idea how the event will play out. So regardless of the magnitude, you know the sea surface temperature anomalies will generally continue to grow until Christmas, and after which time they'll decay. So it gives why scientists are so interested in it. It gives us the ability to kind of enhance forecasts, so seasonal forecasts of rainfall and temperature for various regions.
In the Northern Hemisphere, say in America, we would start to look for this to build, say, in September and then peak in December. Is that what I'm getting from this?
Yeah. But so basically, so what we're seeing so far to date, I'm not sure if you're aware, they're actually anticipating or forecasting, you know, a 70% likelihood for an El Nino event to occur this coming Christmas. And what basically happens at the moment, there's kind of the initiation of the event appears to have been started. There's been these kind of big wind bursts in the equatorial region that have basically started sloshing the water from the west towards the east. Once the water gets to the east, it requires the atmosphere to respond to the changes in sea surface temperature, and then this acts to further enhance the changes in sea surface temperature. So it's kind of what we call a positive feedback. So once this positive feedback starts, and once you can see that it's actually happening, which should take place in the next several months, we should be there, then have a lot more confidence in our forecasts.
Well, let's follow up with a second letter published this past January in the journal Nature Climate Change. It's exactly what many of us worry about. The title is Increasing Frequency of Extreme El Nino Events Due to Greenhouse Warming. First of all, how would you describe an extreme El Nino event?
So like I said before, an extreme one is actually when the rainfall anomalies associated with the event move all of the way from so they're normally located in the western equatorial Pacific, and they move all of the way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific. So that's how they classify extreme ENSO events, but it's this rainfall response. So it's instead of putting heat up into the atmosphere, which drives the global circulation in the western equatorial Pacific, we're moving it a long way, like over 100 degrees in longitude to the east. This in itself will have dramatic changes for the global climate and weather patterns, obviously for a finite period, for you know a six-month period or 12-month period while the event's occurring.
Now, do we have statistical facts showing that extreme El Niños are more frequent? And secondly, how do we know greenhouse warming is a factor instead of some long-term cycle in the oceans?
So at present, so there has only been two of these extreme El Nino events in the observational record, and there's just not enough to show statistically significantly that what we're seeing now is due to climate change. In terms of the future projection, so this is talking about climate model ensembles, and we're talking about, you know, I think kind of 35 different models that have each been run for 100 years. And I think in terms of the natural variability within these models, you don't anticipate each of these different models to have the natural variability in the same phase, do you understand what I mean? So if you picture something as an oscillation, if it's just naturally occurring with the climate system, it won't line up within each of these different models. So when you're looking at the ensemble, so all of the models together, this internal variability will be cancelled out.
It makes sense to me because it's where the word asymmetry comes in, which is we're looking for something here that doesn't fit a pattern. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Basically, so each of the models has its own internal variability, but it's obviously different in all of the models. So when you're looking across all of them, it basically disappears. And then what you're seeing, because the only common thread amongst each of these models is that they have been forced by increasing greenhouse gases.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with climate researcher Shane McGregor at Australia's Climate Research Centre in Sydney. And I'd like to follow up that letter in Nature Climate Change also suggested that El Niños in the future could have profound social and economic impacts. We've touched on that a little bit, but can we go into a bit more detail on the predicted impacts in different parts of the world, say starting with America, and what about Australia and Europe? Does it affect Europe and South America?
Okay, so in terms of starting with the US, I actually think the El Nino events have reasonably good impacts for the US. I think most of California is currently in drought at the moment, and El Nino events generally lead to more rainfall than normal along the US West Coast. And it also it's been linked to kind of milder winters, so not as cold winters for the US. In terms of rainfall for South America, it leads to kind of large-scale floods along much of the west coast of South America, which can be quite devastating. If we go then move along to the southwest Pacific, so off the east coast of Australia, it has dramatic impacts on tropical cyclones and where the cyclones actually form. So reasonably good news for Australia, that the number of cyclones that enter the Australian region is dramatically less during El Nino events. But what happens is these events, where they form, shifts further to the east, okay, and it allows them to form in regions over and around Fiji, Samoa, Tonga. So these regions are much more likely to be impacted by tropical cyclones during El Nino events. Australia in general, El Nino events lead to much drier conditions and much hotter conditions, so it has been linked to drought, large-scale drought over much of the east coast of Australia.
That sounds interesting, and especially about Australia, because you just had a record hot year in 2013. It's hard to imagine it getting much hotter, but it sounds like it could.
Yeah, that's true. And also 2013, currently at present, I think 50% of New South Wales and 80% of Queensland is currently drought declared. So, and this is in the absence of any kind of major El Nino event. So if an El Nino event was to come along this year and cause it to be even drier, I can't imagine it would be a good scenario for the farmers in those regions.
And can this weather system reach as far as Europe, or is it dissipated and other things are playing there?
I think it plays a less of a role, but it's definitely been linked to, I think, like the ski season and kind of rainfall and storminess in those regions. It's also linked to increased dryness over the Indian subcontinent. It kind of really has global effects. I think it's also even been linked, I think maybe the statistics and the number of events that you kind of, is kind of limited, but it's also been linked to rainfall along the east coast of Africa. So it does have like kind of globally reaching effects.
Well, scientists are famous for their uncertainty, and we've heard some of it in this interview. What are some of the things we don't know about El Nino that we'd like to know?
So I suppose one of the main things that we don't know that we'd like to know is how El Nino has reacted in the past. So basically, we've got really, really good observations of the tropical Pacific from about the mid-1980s until present day. This is kind of changing a little bit now. Our observational network is kind of going down a little bit at the moment. So we've got a really good observational network for about 20 to 30 years there. Prior to that, we kind of have reasonably good observations. So we're talking about kind of ship tracks for about the 30 years before that. So from about 1950 to 1960, we've got an idea of what was happening in the tropical Pacific. But it turns out when we look in these climate models, you kind of really need 500 or 600 years to really understand like how much the natural variability ENSO has in terms of its magnitudes and occurrence rates. And so definitely one of the main things we don't know, or one of the main things we need, is more observation and better observations, basically.
And we've talked about the oceans. Does the ocean water actually get hotter? Does El Nino affect ocean life as well?
Oh, it definitely affects ocean life. It has huge implications for kind of coral reefs and fisheries. So I think in terms of the US, I think in terms of California, so basically when an El Nino happens off the west coast of South America, the warm waters warm up. And this allows a lot more tropical fish to kind of move further northwards. some of the negative impacts of this are that the salmon in the Pacific Northwest suffer because kind of Pacific mackerel kind of can push northward along the coast and they tend to eat the young salmon and compete with the adult salmon for food. So it has dramatic impacts on the salmon population. But also, I think from what I understand, commercial fishermen or like sports fishermen actually enjoy it a lot more because they get to catch a lot more different fish than what they would normally catch due to these warm waters.
And it's really bad for coral as well, as I understand it, which is already threatened in many places in the world.
Yeah, that's true. So I think most of the eastern half of the equatorial Pacific can generally get much warmer than normal, and it can lead to bleaching events kind of in these regions. I think at present, it's kind of the global warming is kind of already kind of increasing sea surface temperatures in these regions as well, increasing the occurrence of bleaching events. And this is just another thing kind of to add on to, have an impact on coral reefs.
So at what point in this year of 2014 would you feel confident saying, yes, we will have an El Nino this winter or next spring? When do you expect one?
I do expect one, and I was at a conference recently talking with a lot of other people that kind of are researching and so on. I think a large proportion of the community expects one, and I think, like I said, the probability of one occurring is estimated around 70%. As in terms of when I would be confident to say there's definitely going to be El Nino, it's probably not going to be until around September. But in saying that, I think it was September in 2012, sea surface temperatures had breached kind of El Nino thresholds, and it was on the verge of being declared an event, and then it just pretty much dissipated straight away. So that was the first time that had happened in the kind of very limited observational record. So in the last kind of 30 or 40 years, that's the first time that had actually been observed to happen, like an event kind of really start and look like it was going to go and then stop. So I think come September, I think we'll have much more of an idea. So once we get through this, the Northern Hemisphere winter or the American winter, we'll have much better ideas, and the models will also give us much better information in regards to the potential amplitude of the event.
Is there anything that I've missed that you think the public ought to know about this powerful weather machine?
I suppose one of the biggest things is we asked, like, while we do have a pretty good understanding of how it operates, we're still learning about it, and we really need to keep up our observations of the tropical Pacific, and this includes many measures, so like satellite observations, and at the moment there's an array of buoys that are kind of moored in the tropical Pacific. And I think there's 70-plus buoys moored around the tropical Pacific at present. And the thing is, from about 1994, this array network has been fully functional and it's been operating about 90% capacity. But in the last 2 years, it's kind of been underserviced. And the amount of data that is returning from this network is about 40. So of those 70, roughly kind of 20 to 30 of them are actually sending information back to us at the moment. So it's looking like it's going to be a little bit precarious. I think we really need to keep investing in this observational network.
We've been talking with Dr. Shane McGregor. He's a research fellow at Australia's Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. You can find links to the science and news we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. You can also find this interview on Radio EcoShock's sound page after a few days, and you can pass it on to other people from there. Dr. McGregor, thank you so much for spending time with our listeners.
Okay, thanks a lot for having us, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.